All right, if you have a Bible, please turn to Isaiah chapter 10. Now, we have some new faces here tonight. So what on Sunday night, it's a Bible study, and you've got your outline there in front of you. We're going through the book of Isaiah. The book of Isaiah is very uneven, I suppose, as far as its level of interest. There's some places that are absolutely fascinating, and there's other places where, unless you're a history buff, it's going to be like, huh, I don't get this. And so we're going to be looking actually at a split between those two things here in Isaiah chapter 10. Remember that during the course of Israel's history, you had this roller coaster effect. We see this in microcosm in the period of the Judges, where you have about 400 years of Israel's history jammed into a 21 or 22 chapter book. And then you have the kingdom, which takes not too much longer than that, about almost the same amount of time, but a lot more details. And instead of a judge and a non-hereditary position, you now have a king. And the kingdom split after the reign of Solomon, and you had a northern kingdom with its capital at Samaria. And then you had the southern kingdom still under the line of David, there headquartered in Jerusalem. And here we are dealing with chronologically what will be the tail end of the northern kingdom of Israel, with its headquarters, its capital there in Samaria. The southern kingdom is going to be under King Hezekiah during part of what is going to be prophesied in the section we're looking at. On the international scene, you have the empire of Assyria, which would be in what is now northern Iraq. Sort of in the southern part of the Kurdistan area, if you remember from 10, 12, 15 years ago when they were constantly showing you maps of Iraq on the news and stuff. The Assyrian Empire was an empire that had grown, had gone through several pulses, contracting pretty much of its own accord. If they lacked manpower or the king lacked initiative to build or maintain an empire. But it went through several periods of expansion. It was an old empire. It had come into being over 1,000 years prior to the section here that we're looking at in the book of Isaiah. And generally speaking, after they had been established as an empire, as a kingdom, even though it lasted for hundreds and hundreds of years, this is the place that Jonah was sent to, by the way, that even though they lasted, they had never lost a battle. They were a winning enterprise as far as military was concerned. And we are going to see something here at the end of this chapter that is an anomaly as far as Assyrian history is concerned. It's a very important one as well. One of the things that often is the case with people who are always winners is they become arrogant. And they also think they're invincible. And so here, beginning in verse 10, the first four verses of this chapter actually go with chapter 9, as we saw last time. And so it says, O Assyrian. Now, in the Hebrew language, it isn't O Assyrian. It's woe is Assyria. And because we have a woe coming here, this is news that is not good if you are a fan of the Assyrian Empire. It says, O Assyrian, or woe to Assyria, the rod of mine anger and the staff in thine hand is mine indignation. I sent him, this is God talking about Assyria, I sent him against a hypocritical nation, against an ungodly nation, against a nation that should have known but did not know the things of God, and against the people in my wrath I gave him a charge to take spoil, to take a prey, and to tread them down like the mire in the streets. Now, what he's talking about here is the northern kingdom of Israel. The Assyrians did come. They conquered the northern kingdom. They sacked the villages and so on. And then 10 years later, they came back and they destroyed the northern kingdom. They laid siege to the northern kingdom, to the capital of Assyria, or of Samaria, rather. And the siege lasted for 3 years. And finally, the city was taken. and the survivors carried off, for the most part, into slavery, into various other components of the Assyrian Empire. The Assyrians had a policy of swapping peoples, and this would help break down nationality and patriotism and rebellion. And so what they did is they deported those that they had conquered there in Israel and brought in other people, and the people that they brought in mingled over a period of time with the Israelites were left, and that's where the Samaritan people came from. And they also not only mixed as far as ethnicity and so on is concerned, but they also mixed their religion. And the Samaritan religion, which still exists today, there are still Samaritans in north central Israel today, still practicing the same religion that they did there in the New Testament era, is sort of it's almost a cult of Judaism, because it has all these pagan components in it that are mixed in with their Judaism. And so you have God had called for Assyria to be the rod in his hand, to be the implement, the tool of his judgment on the northern kingdom of Israel. Howbeit, he says there in verse 9, he meaneth not so, or this was not his understanding. This is wasn't what Assyria was thinking. Neither doth he think, doth his heart think so. But it is in his heart to destroy and to cut off nations and not a few. His idea is empire building. His idea is power. His idea is wealth. And this is what the Assyrians did. The Assyrian Empire was gigantic. As far as modern politics are concerned, as far as the countries that would have been in part of the Assyrian Empire at its greatest, you're talking about the eastern end of Turkey, all of Iraq, portions of Iran, all of Syria, Lebanon, Israel, Jordan, and even parts of Egypt. All those areas that I just mentioned would have been a part of the Assyrian Empire at this time or shortly after this period of time. And so it was huge. It was much bigger than Nebuchadnezzar's empire. It was the biggest thing that there was until the Persians came along. And they would come in and they would loot and pillage and bring others under their control. And it says in verse 8, "For he saith, are not my princes altogether kings?" Now the princes were not necessarily members of the royal family, but if you have your capital at Nineveh, which was the capital of the Assyrian Empire there in what is northern Iraq on the Tigris River. And now remember, this isn't modern communications. If you want news to get from Nineveh to, say, Egypt, or news to get from Nineveh to Damascus in Syria or someplace like that, hundreds of miles away, you would send a courier on a horse or possibly a camel, depending on where they were, and it would take him several days to get there. He would stop, and then they'd have outposts where he'd get a fresh mount, and off he'd go again, and he's carrying his pouch that has his sealed documents in it, and that's how it would get from point A to point B. And it might take days, a number of days, maybe even weeks, to get from point A to point B as far as information is concerned. And of course, you have no guarantee that the fellow isn't going to be waylaid along the way by robbers or whatever, or maybe he's got a flat tire on his donkey or something. And so how do you guarantee that these outposts that you have conquered, that you have traveled hundreds and hundreds of miles on horseback or by foot with your armies, and you come and you lay siege and you conquer Syria or you conquer Egypt or you conquer Samaria or you conquer one of these places, how are you going to guarantee that they are going to continue to be part of your empire? Well, there's always the threat that you're going to reinvade them, which happened from time to time, because they had to pay tribute and so on. Tax money had to come in. And again, a long, tedious process of loading it up in a caravan with all these soldiers and everything to guard it because it's so valuable, and then taking it back to Nineveh. But how can you guarantee that you're not going to have a rebellion in Egypt? How are you going to guarantee, as best possible, that you're not going to have a rebellion in Samaria, one of these places? Well, what you do is you install a governor who is that you're pretty tight with. Now, even then, that was not always a guarantee. Sometimes you would have a rebellion because he's looking at the wealth or he's looking at the circumstances. He says, you know, I think I could defend this place against the Assyrian army. But generally speaking, they would put loyal people in place, and that governor was basically king over this province. And so that's one of the things that he's alluding to there in verse 8. For he saith, are not my princes, my leaders, my captains, altogether kings? They are ruling over what used to be independent nations. They are now governors under the king of Assyria, but they are ruling as kings. And then he has a list of different places here, beginning in verse 9. He says, is not Calno as Carchemish, Is not Hamath as Arpad? Is not Samaria as Damascus? What in the world is he talking about? He's talking about the different nations, different cities, primarily, that were conquered by the Assyrians over their history. And some of these cities are quite large. Where are these places? Well, we know where Samaria is. Samaria would be in north central Israel. The rest of the places are in Syria or in northern Iraq, areas that would be west of the Assyrians themselves. And so as they would come across, let me get it from your perspective. Here's Assyria. I'm going to do my awful map over here of the Middle East. Here we have the Tigris, and here's the Persian Gulf, PG. And then we have the Euphrates River. And back then, they did not dovetail. They came into the Persian Gulf separately. Today, they dovetail. And you had, say, Nineveh's capital is here. Well, then you had several other cities over here. Babylon is way down over here. And then you had another river. Here's the Mediterranean coast. Here's Israel and Jerusalem right there. And then you had another river that started right close by but didn't flow into there, and it was called the Orontes. Very important river in northern Syria today. And you had mountains along here. And so along this strip, you guys remember this from social studies when you were a kid? This is the Fertile Crescent, all right? Either they've got irrigation by the rivers or they get rainfall over here so they can have people and crops. Because there's nothing here. This is a giant sandbox, okay, here in the middle. So when you had an empire, they bypassed. Matter of fact, they couldn't even travel across this. Even with a camel caravan, you couldn't travel across this. It was just too desolate. There's no place, there's no water, there's no nothing here. And so they would go up and over the top. And so the Assyrians had conquered this whole thing. And the cities that are listed are in this region up here. All those cities that are listed except for Samaria, which would be right there, which is about 20, 30 miles north of Jerusalem. And so he has a list of cities there in verse 9. And he says in verse 10, as my hand hath found the kingdoms of the idols, of their gods, because each of these nations, each of these cities had their own pet god. They had a big pantheon. They worshipped a whole bunch of gods. But you would have the patron god of, for example, Babylon would be Marduk. You would have the patron god of this city would be this guy over here. Different favored, would be, believe it or not, their god was called Sin, the moon god. You had a number of different gods that had a temple, a big temple in these different cities. And when the Assyrians came in and conquered, they would trump and say, our god is more powerful than your god. That's how they perceived it. And so as the Assyrians conquered all these different cities here, as they moved and built their empire here to the west, as they did this, they made the decree, they made the assertion that our gods are more powerful. And as we come down and go and have conquered these places, he says in verse 11, shall I not, as I have done unto Samaria and unto her idols, her gods, her false gods, so do to Jerusalem and her idols, her gods. And this is where, as far as God is concerned, the real problem is. We see this time and time again, that when God is challenged by a foreign empire, by a foreign king or something like that, he loses. Did they have idols in Samaria? Did they have idols in the northern kingdom of Israel? Yes, they did. Did they worship the Lord? Sort of. Remember that after the kingdom split, you had a fellow named Jeroboam. You go read through the book of 1 and 2 Kings. You had, and he departed not from the sin of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. Always the sin of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. What was the sin of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, which is so prominent as you read the books of Kings? Well, after the kingdom split, after Solomon died, Rehoboam, Solomon's son, ruling from Jerusalem, and then a guy who wasn't related, a guy named Jeroboam, was given the kingdom, or took the kingdom, in the north. Now, in ancient Israel, they didn't have synagogues in the Old Testament era until after the captivity, until after the period of the kings. They had the temple there in Jerusalem. And if you were to worship God, if you were to bring your sacrifice, or you were to come for one of the festivals, if you were to come to Passover, or to the Feast of Unleavened Bread, or to the Feast of First Fruits, or Feast of Tabernacles, or one of these things that you're supposed to come to. Remember, there were three feasts that were mandatory. You were required to come to these things. If you lived in Israel, any place in the whole of Israel, when it was time for one of these feasts, you made a pilgrimage and you came to Jerusalem. That was the place of worship. And when the kingdom split, Jeroboam, thinking strictly politically and not spiritually, began to think, you know, if we continue to have these pilgrimages down to Jerusalem, then all the people in my kingdom, when they go down there, they're going to see Jerusalem and they're going to switch loyalty and they're going to start to favor the king down in Jerusalem instead of me. And pretty soon they're going to want to get rid of me and they're going to want to return their loyalty to the line of David, and I'm going to lose my head. So he said, we're going to change policy here. We're still going to worship the Lord. We're still going to worship the God of Israel, but instead of going to Jerusalem, we're going to build two shrines. We're going to have two altars. We're going to have one in Dan, way up in the north, north of the Sea of Galilee, up in this area here, as far north as you could go in Israel and still have Israelites. And we're going to build another one in Bethel, which is just a little ways north of Jerusalem, about 3 miles north of Jerusalem. And we're going to build altars there, and we're going to put golden calves there, as they did in Exodus chapter 32. And they did the same thing that was done there after in Exodus 32. These be thy gods, O Israel, which brought thee up out of the land of Israel, or out of the land of Egypt. And so they are worshiping the true God, but they are using these calves and saying, these are your gods. So it's this mixed thing. Are they worshiping God? Sort of. But they are using this golden calf as a symbol to represent God. And it's creating confusion. So they are this, and the Bible says that was sin. That was sin. And so, Samaria continued with their idols, but it was not quite the same thing as, say, the idols in Babylon or Carchemish or some of these other cities. And so the Assyrian is saying, you know, none of these gods were able to stop me. None of the gods of these various cities were able to stop me as I came in. I'm building my empire. I came in and they put their confidence in their gods and all these different cities that are over here, and we conquered them and it didn't make any difference. Their gods weren't strong enough, and I'm going to do the same thing to Jerusalem because their God is no different than the gods of the rest of the cities. That's what he is saying there in verse 11. Jerusalem is going to suffer the same fate as everybody else. Wherefore? Verse 12, and when you have a wherefore, you're dealing with a transition that is based on the previous information. It shall come to pass that when the Lord hath performed his whole work upon Mount Zion and on Jerusalem, I will punish. In other words, there will be some suffering. There will be some hardship. We talked about this before, that when the Assyrian flood comes in, Jerusalem is going to be up to their neck. They'll be standing on their tiptoes to keep themselves alive. The Assyrian flood is going to come over and he's going to wipe out Damascus. He's going to wipe out the Syrians. He's going to wipe out Samaria and the northern kingdom of Israel. And he's going to come down into Judah. But they're not going to be wiped out, but they're going to be up to their neck in it. And he says, I will punish the fruit of the stout heart of the king of Assyria and the glory of his high looks. What are high looks? This doesn't mean he's looking at the top of the mountain or looking at the stars. What is a high look? Proud. He's proud. He's arrogant. Again, I have built this big empire. I, by my power and might, have built this gigantic empire. And there's an assertion of self in verses 13 through 14. I is mentioned 6 times. My is mentioned 3 times. He's very self-centered, very self-focused. Because he is, in his own mind anyway, his own God. And that's true with, in the deep, dark recesses of our minds, that's true with most people. And yet, the fact of the matter is, and this is the same thing will be true with Nebuchadnezzar, here a few generations down the road, that God is using the Assyrians as his tool of judgment, and the Assyrians are oblivious to it. And later on, God is going to be using the Babylonians as his tool of judgment, and the Babylonians are going to be oblivious to it. And they think it's because of their own power and their own strength, but the fact of the matter is that God has enabled them to do this because God is using them as a tool to accomplish his purpose. And it says there in verse 15, God says, in reference to the Assyrians are saying, by the strength of my hand I have done this. And by my wisdom, my brilliance, my prudence, I have removed the bounds of people and have robbed their treasures and have put down the inhabitants like a valiant man. And my hand hath found as a nest the riches of the people, as one gathereth eggs that are left, picking out the looting these nations like gathering eggs at a hen house. But God says in verse 15, shall the axe boast itself against him that hews with it, who's swinging the axe? Or shall the saw magnify itself against him that, I love this, shaketh it? In English, if I'm doing this, what do we call that? I'm sawing, but what is the motion called? Sawing, okay. In Hebrew, it's not that way. You don't say, I'm moving my arm this way, and therefore I am sawing. It's a word that can be translated a number of different ways, including, I'm shaking the saw, and that's what it's talking about here. So when it says shaking, it's not like waving the saw around. It's sawing with the saw. So if I've got an axe, I should have done this. I should have had David go out to the shed and bring in a saw and an axe. I've got an axe. Okay, show me your stuff. Go cut down a tree. It's still sitting there. I could say the same thing as far as a saw is concerned. Okay, saw, do your stuff. Now, what's it need? It needs power. It needs somebody to wield it in order for it to do what it needs to do. The Assyrian is the axe. The Assyrian is the saw. Well, who's swinging the axe, and who's sawing with the saw? God is. But the Assyrian, which is the axe and the saw, doesn't realize it. They think that they're doing it on their own. Sorry, it doesn't work that way. Therefore, verse 16, shall the Lord, the God of hosts, send among his fat ones leanness. Some of us might appreciate that, or need that, I should say. And under his glory shall he kindle a burning like the burning of a fire. Judgment is going to come on these folks. They will be destroyed by disease and by fire. And it says in verse 17, and the light of Israel shall be for a fire, and the Holy One for a flame, and it shall burn and devour his thorns and his briars in one day. One day. Now, I want you to keep your finger here. And this is in two places here in your Bibles, maybe even three. But I want you to go to the text that I've got listed there, Isaiah 37. By the way, the middle section of Isaiah is almost exactly the same as the corresponding section of history in the book of 2 Kings, which tells you that Isaiah probably wrote that section of 2 Kings. Now, the middle section here of Isaiah is history. Is history. Again, same thing you see in 2 Kings. And you have good King Hezekiah, one of the best kings Judah ever had. Good King Hezekiah is on the throne. Isaiah, the prophet, is there. And Assyria is besieging Jerusalem. They have taken almost all the rest of the cities of Judah. The inhabitants of Judah, instead of staying out in their little vulnerable villages, had all piled into Jerusalem because it was a heavily fortified city, very difficult to take under the war conditions of the day. And the circumstances are looking very, very bleak. And at the beginning of the chapter, Hezekiah asks Isaiah to pray, pray, pray. And God answers the prayer. And I want you to go toward the end of the chapter and look in verse 32. For out of Jerusalem shall go forth a remnant, the survivors of Judah, and they that escape out of Mount Zion, the zeal of the Lord of hosts, will do this thing. Therefore, thus saith the Lord concerning the king of Assyria, he shall not come into this city, nor shall he shoot an arrow there, nor come against it with shields or cast a bank against it, various methods of siege warfare. By the way that he came, the same route that he came, by the same shall he return and shall not come into this city, saith the Lord. For I will, now this is unheard of. The Assyrians had always taken every city that they had ever tried to take. And here we have an exception. And historically, this is the only known exception. Verse 35, Lord says, for I will defend this city to save it, for mine own sake and for my servant David's sake. And here's what happened. Verse 36, then the angel of the Lord went forth and smote in the camp of the Assyrians 185,000. Overnight, 185,000 soldiers died in the trenches around Jerusalem under the siege. And when they arose in the morning, behold, they were all dead corpses. Now, this doesn't mean everybody. We're going to find out when we go back to the text we're looking at that it was a majority that died. But not everybody. And so the survivors came out of their trenches in the morning. And you know, you got one guy climbing out of the trench and his 17 comrades are lying there dead. And they had to withdraw. And they marched back up to Assyria in defeat. And it's the only time in Assyrian history where that happened. Now, why is that important? Why is that important? Let's go back to Isaiah 10. Why is that important, by the way? It says there in that it was going to be in one day. And shall consume the glory of his forest, the forest of his soldiers. The imagery there. And of his fruitful field. For both soul and body, as when a standard beareth faith, and it says in verse 19, and the rest of the trees of his forest shall be few, so that a child may write them. A little child would go, 1, 2, 3, there'd be so few left that a small child would be able to count them. Why? Let's try a little hindsight. Why did God do that? Because God did it. Hezekiah said, pray, and God answered the prayer. Wasn't because of the military might of Hezekiah that this happened. This was due to God's intervention. Why did God do this? Well, first of all, we saw this already, the challenge of the Assyrian king. You people there in Jerusalem are no different than any place else I've conquered. Well, they are different. They are different. The God of Israel is not the same as the gods of the rest of the nations. We're going to find out later on in the book of Isaiah. Isaiah says that you the rest of the gods are stone and wood. But the God of Israel is the living God, the creator God. Vast, vast difference. One is the figment of a man's imagination and his artistic genius, and the other one is the God who was there before anything else was. And so you have this challenge of God. But if you've been coming to Grace for any length of time, we've talked a little bit about biblical covenants, Abrahamic covenant, Davidic covenant, and so forth. And God makes promises, and when God makes promises, he must keep his promises. Assyrian policy was that if you captured a city, if you conquered one of these cities, you deported the inhabitants, you brought in other people, so you had a mixed bag. What did you do with the king? He had one of two things. Either he's a trophy back home in a dungeon. You can go down to your prison and you're feeding these smelly, slobbering, starving people through little slots in the door and says, yeah, this guy was the king of so-and-so, this guy was the king of so-and-so, this guy was the king of so-and-so. It's kind of like your trophy, your war trophies, living war trophies. They would do that sometimes. And then, but more often than not, it's much, much simpler to just go cut the guy's head off. And sometimes the Syrians, I saw a illustration of this in a book 2 days ago. An Assyrian garden party hosted by the king of Assyria. And why was he having a garden party? Because he had defeated one of these cities over here. And as the servants are going around, would you like an hors d'oeuvre with that? You know, going around and having the soft music is playing. And they have a tree over here in the middle of the garden. And hanging from the tree is the head of the defeated king. You know, let's bypass the head as I offer you your hors d'oeuvres. And it's kind of, because it was really funny. You got this tree, there's a head hanging there upside down in the tree, and you have all these servants walking by with trays in the picture. And it wasn't a reproduction. It was actually the monument that was done by the Assyrian king to commemorate this event. Israel is different. Israel is different. God has to keep his word, has to keep his promise. One of David's heirs will occupy his throne forever. The Assyrian flood came in. Where are all of David's heirs? They're all in Jerusalem. Now, there might be some cousins and second cousins and so on of Hezekiah that are descended ultimately from David. I think we've seen before that Isaiah was probably of the royal line, although he was, you know, second cousin thrice removed or whatever the case may be. But all the heirs, all the means humanly at God's disposal to fulfill his promise that he had made to David were all inside that little city, inside the sea of the Assyrians. And in order for God to keep his word, he must spare the line, because Assyrian policy did not allow for that sparing to take place. Babylonian policy did. But the Assyrian policy did not allow for that. And therefore, for God to keep his word, Jerusalem couldn't be taken. Not under the normal circumstances, anyway. The nation must be preserved. The city must be preserved. The line of David, most importantly, must be preserved. And so here's what happened. Remember, the rest of the country, except for maybe one or two other fortified cities, was taken. Jerusalem is an island in the midst of an Assyrian sea. And then God intervenes. The army is decimated. The Assyrians go back home. And after the Assyrians leave, everybody that's packed into this little city, which isn't that big, especially in this day, wasn't as big as it is today, came streaming out and refilled the land. And you have promises that they would again fill the land. And it says in verse 20, it shall come to pass in that day that the remnant of Israel and such as are escaped out of the house of Jacob shall no more stay upon him that smote them, or no longer depend is the word stay there, or rely upon them, but shall rely or trust upon the Lord, the Holy One of Israel in truth. They'd never done that before. The remnant shall return, even the remnant of Jacob, unto the mighty God. For though thy people Israel be as the sand of the sea, yet as far as what they were before, yet a remnant of them shall return. The consumption decreed shall overflow with righteousness. For the Lord God of hosts shall make a consumption even determined in the midst of the land. And generally speaking, you got differences of opinion, but this little section here is probably in reference to the northern kingdom. They were decimated. They were wiped out prior to the Assyrian invasion. Their population was probably over 1 million. And when the Assyrians were all done, you're talking about tens of thousands of people left. And many people were deported. Now, are the 10 lost tribes really lost? No. Small minority. Even in the New Testament era, you have people that were not of Benjamin and not of Levi and not of Judah, but were one of the other tribes. You have somebody mentioned in the book in Luke chapter 2 who was from the tribe of Asher. And so these tribes came back, a small remnant. Why do those tribes have to exist? Why do you have to have at least a remnant of Naphtali and Gad and Asher and Reuben and Zebulun and these other tribes? Why do you have to have that remnant there? Prophecy has to be fulfilled. Prophecy has to be fulfilled. I'm sorry to inform you, but the Jehovah's Witnesses are wrong. The 144,000 are not the Jehovah's Witnesses. They are actually Israelites of the 12 tribes, 12,000 from each tribe. And therefore, when we get to the millennial age, or not millennial, but get to the tribulation, and you have the 144,000 going out and preaching the gospel of the kingdom, you have to have that many people from each tribe at that point in time. You have to have those people. Prophecy has to be fulfilled, and therefore they must be preserved. Verse 24. When you're under the heel of another empire, and before the Assyrian invasion came in, Judah was actually paying some tribute to Assyria to keep them back, to hold them off. And so you had, when you're paying tribute, when you're under the heel of another empire, is that oppressive? Is that difficult? Yes. You know, here we grouse and we alluded to this morning. We grouse and complain about the taxes we pay. Now, theoretically, we get something back, and we do. You know, we get, if something, you know, we can call the fire department, they come. You can call the police department, they come. I got a paved road to travel on between here and there. There's stoplights and stop signs and street lights and a lot of other things that we benefit from as far as our, but if you're under the heel of Assyria or you're under the heel of Babylon or something, you're shelling out money and you're getting nothing in return. It all goes to the home office and they build monuments and everything else in the home city, but the outliers are out of luck. They're feeding the monster back home. And, it was oppressive. It was difficult. And so the promise of deliverance is there beginning in verse 24. In verse 24, we say that there'll be no more need for fear. They're not going to have to worry about future invasions. Verses 25 and 26, I'm skipping over this pretty quickly. Verse 25, for yet a little while, and the indignation shall cease, and mine anger in their destruction, referring to Assyria. Assyria is going to be destroyed. The Lord of hosts will stir up a scourge for him according to the slaughter of Midian and so forth, that Assyria is going to be destroyed. Here you had an empire. Now, when was Nineveh founded? When was Nineveh founded? Old Testament? Oh, long, long time. Nineveh was founded before the call of Abraham. Nineveh is back there in Genesis chapter 11. And even before. Nineveh is an old, old, old city. Founded by Nimrod. Old, old city. You had this slowly growing empire until we get to a time just before David came to the throne. During this period of the Judges, and the Assyrians had already built a small empire. It isn't going to affect Israel for a long time yet. But they'd already built this empire up in that area in northern Iraq. And it went through several pulses, but it was going to be quite a bit later until we get to this time before it actually comes down and expands to this point where it's into Israel. But you have this big, huge, thriving empire. If you read the book of Jonah, you'll find out that their population in that region was in the hundreds of thousands as far as the population of Nineveh and its surrounding villages. Hundreds of thousands. Huge, huge city. Enormous. And very old. At this point, it was already an ancient city. 2,000 years old, maybe. And yet, it's going to be destroyed. And it was never rebuilt. It was never rebuilt. And the Assyrian Empire was crushed and destroyed in very short order. Matter of fact, within 100 years, the Assyrian Empire is gone. There's no more from this point. Here they are at their biggest, and then in short order, they're gone. What happened? How could the most powerful nation on earth all of a sudden be gone in short order? Which, you know, and we're not dealing with the technology and stuff we got today where everything moves real fast. Things move generally pretty slow back in this day. How in the world could this giant, well-organized military machine all of a sudden be gone in 2-3 generations? What happened? Well, if you have beat up a bunch of people really bad and they've survived, they don't like you very much. Especially if they keep getting a beating. They don't like you. And if you've got, my kids know this. I used to wrestle with my kids on Saturday mornings. That was something they looked forward to. Wrestling with Dad on Saturday morning. And they would attack me and we'd do, you know, we did it on the bed generally to avoid bumps and bruises for the most part. But, why did we stop doing that? Why did we stop doing that? No, it got to the point where I became far more concerned about my own safety than theirs. Even though they were both at that stage still considerably smaller than me, if they could coordinate their attack, I was in trouble. I don't think they quite realized that. It was luck of the draw when they coordinated their attack, but you get the idea. When I had to call for my wife to have her check and see if I'd broken a bone or something, you know, it was time to rein this in. And the same thing was true regarding Assyria. Assyria had beaten up its neighbors, and finally a coalition developed. And you had the Babylonians get together with the Medes and the Persians, and they formed a joint, because neither one of them was as mighty as the Assyrians. But those two together, that's another thing. And those two got together, and they beat the Assyrians together. Now, later on, they had conflicts between them, and one of them ended up conquering the other. But together, those two were able to wipe out the Assyrians, and that's what happened here. And it happened in short order. It happened in short order. And so there's a description, and so the burden is removed from Israel. The yoke that they had to bear, the tribute that they had to pay, all that has been removed because Assyria has been destroyed. And then we have the nature of the judgment, a description of it in the last few verses there, beginning in verse 28. It describes the rout of the invaders. There's a list of towns here, and I'm not going to, some of them are difficult to pronounce. I'm not going to go through that long list of towns, beginning verse 28 down through 32. They actually know, there's a list of 12 towns here. They know where eight of them are. And these are, you know, you go to the Middle East and you see what is called a tell. It's a hill. You're out on the plain or this gently, and you got this little high hill here. Well, what is that? Well, that's a man-made hill, actually, because at one point there was a city there. And what were cities made out of for the most part in that part of the world? Mud. You know, sun-dried bricks and stuff. They used some rock in different places, but depending on where you, but it was mud. And mud over a period of time, especially when you got the winds blowing and stuff like that, the stuff accumulates dirt and stuff from the surrounding areas, and you end up with basically a sand dune or a dirt dune there, and you have a hill. And they dig down into the hill, and they found, hey, there's a city under here. And so they've dug up a bunch of these, and they have found 8 of the 12 cities here. Some they don't know exactly where they are, but they know they're in a region, because what you've got here is a description of the towns that are from 8 miles north of Jerusalem to within about 2 miles north of Jerusalem. It's a sort of a zigzag thing, but it's that region between 8 and 2 miles north of Jerusalem that are that list of towns. And it's the route that the Assyrians took on their way to Jerusalem. The route of the invaders. And these were taken by the Assyrians on their way south. Most of these wouldn't have had big walls. They would have had a small little wall around them, maybe 10, 12 feet high, but that would be easily taken by the Assyrians. They were not on a really great location as far as a mountaintop or hilltop or something for defense. And so this would be the route that was taken. And so it says there in verse 32, as yet shall he remain at Nob, which would be the last one, just a little bit north. He shall shake his hand against the mount of the daughter of Zion, the hill of Jerusalem. He's arrived at Jerusalem, and he's ready to take Jerusalem. He's gonna vanquish this last one. He's come here for the purpose of taking Jerusalem. And it takes two verses to explain what happened to the Assyrians when they came. Behold, verse 33, the Lord of hosts shall lop the bough with terror. The high ones of stature shall be hewn down, and the haughty shall be humbled. And he shall cut down the thickets of the forest with iron, and Lebanon shall fall by a mighty one. Lebanon would be the huge forests of the cedars that were up there to the north of Israel. I have some friends that live east of the mountains, but he used to live over on this side. And he and his family owned a little piece of property outside of Yelm. And they had a little vacation place there, and that's where they used to hang out, go out there on the weekends, or sometimes spend a week or two out there and gather on the campfire, and there was a river nearby. And then there was a trail. There was a number of other small sites like that, a number of other little vacation homes along there. But about a half a mile up, there was a little trail that went up, and there was I don't know how many acres it was, probably 50 or 60 acres of old-growth forest up there. And the kids, when they were little, used to love to go up there into that old growth forest and these towering fir trees and so on. And they loved to go up there and play. And they came one time for their vacation, and the kids went up the road, and the forest was gone. Oh, it's worth a lot of money. It's a lot of timber. You know, somebody had logged it off, planted a bunch of little ones, you know. And in another 200 years, they'll have an old growth forest again. That's what's described here. The forest is cleared. You have a clear cutting of the Assyrians. And it's the Lord that's wielding the axe. As he used the Assyrians, and he was the power of using them as the saw and the axe, so he will use somebody else to clear cut the Assyrians. And as far as Jerusalem is concerned, he used probably disease to kill all those Assyrians in a night. We don't know for sure what did it, but God used some tool in his arsenal to dispose of these folks in one night. And as somebody comes through and clears a forest, so the Assyrian army was cleared out in a night. And of course, about three generations later, the whole empire was cleared out in a matter of months. What was the and in the end it says they shall fall as the idea of end of verse 33, the haughty, the proud, the arrogant shall be humbled, because what got them in trouble in the first place? Their arrogance. Their arrogance. So we see, because it's kind of interesting. We look at the world around us today and we wonder who's going to stop these folks and what's going to happen here. And yet, at this time, Assyria was the world power. You didn't have multiple world powers, and so you had one. You had a couple of other guys that were reasonably powerful, but Babylon and Persia and so on were paying tribute to the Assyrians just to keep them off their backs. You had one world power, and yet in short order, it's done and gone with. And when they stepped out of line, when they challenged God personally, in a night, it's done with. We serve an all-powerful, we go back to what we had this morning, we serve an omnipotent God who is sovereign. And that is cause for comfort, because we are his children. We are not part of the enemy. We are not opponents of the Lord, at least hope not. But he is our Father, and he is the one who cares for us. And in spite of the apparent strength of the enemy about us, God can't be thwarted. And God will fulfill his word in spite of what anybody else might say or do. All right, any questions or comments on what we looked at tonight? Yes?
Nebuchadnezzar in the time of Assyria?
No, Nebuchadnezzar was actually, Nebuchadnezzar's father was the Babylonian king who hooked up with the Medes and the Persians to wipe out Assyria.
Oh, okay, that's okay.
And then as the Babylonian Empire was growing, Nebuchadnezzar's dad died, and then he took over the empire and built it into the great big thing that it was by the time we get to the time of Daniel and Jeremiah and so forth. So it's going to be another about 3-4 generations after this time before Babylon is the dominant power. Similar area. They took over this. Babylon's down here. Assyria was up here. The Medes and Persians were over here. And so these guys came in and took this. And then the Medes and Persians built an empire up here, and then Babylon took this whole area. And then after Nebuchadnezzar's death, then we had the Persians come in, and they ended up taking Babylon, and then took over everything all the way over. And they ended up ruling from Pakistan, the edge of Pakistan, all the way to Libya in North Africa. They had a huge empire, and that lasted for about 150, 200 years, and then it was wiped out in 10 years. The whole thing was conquered in 10 years by one young upstart named Alexander the Great. So things change quickly. Things change quickly. Those who are all-powerful now, seemingly, it's fleeting. It's fleeting. Okay, any other questions? All right, let's close in prayer. Father, thank you so much for your power, for your authority. And Father, sometimes we're intimidated, we're frightened by world events of today. The uncertainty, the rise of things, it's almost like the 1930s all over again. And yet, Father, you're in charge, you're in control, and no one can stop you. And Father, you do these things for your purpose. And as we see with the line of David, the promises that you have made must come to pass. And Father, thank you also that we are your children. Ultimately, we will rule and reign with you in the kingdom that you will establish. Father, thank you for these things. We pray for Christ's sake. Amen.